live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Got my mojo
working, but just don't worry. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Why a walk in the woods really does help your body and your soul. From University of in Japan, Chiba University. Then we're going to look at all about vegetarians avoiding more cancers, involving 60,000 people who were followed for a long period of time. This was published in the British Journal of Cancer. Then we're going to look at how poverty and inequality make us eat more, University of St. Andrews, which is in Scotland, and slow aging with blueberries, and St. John's wort, again proven better than antidepressant drugs, plus a lot more on health and healing, all from quality science, always cited. Then we're going to take a look at what Martha Rosenberg from The Influence says about the 10 of the worst big pharma company ripoffs and their plan to keep the gravy train rolling. So how about a drug that cost you for 1 year $300,000 to treat a form of cystic fibrosis? How about another drug that helps treat seizures in infants under 2 years of age? $300,000. And on it goes. We'll talk about that. It's going to be a little of a balancing act, but I'm going to try to present as many independent scholarly positions today as possible on why do people around the world who once thought we were really terrific, and we were a beacon for democracy and ethics and helping people, why have we gotten to where we are at? And that includes right here in the United States. Why are so many Americans feeling disenfranchised? Why are so many Americans looking at Bernie Sanders or for that matter, a Donald Trump? To help them, well, I'm going to give you two perspectives. One will be a historical perspective, and this is going to be rather neat because you're not familiar with this. And I'm going to play probably 10 minutes, plutocracy, political repression in the United States. Plutocracy, very comprehensive understanding of early American history through the lens of class. And this is from Scott Noble. And it just shows you what it's like if you were born in, let's say, the 1800s, early 1900s, in my state of West Virginia. Now, I used to go up into the hollows, what were called the hollows, meet the hollow people. And this discussion you're going to hear is about the people that I knew. And they have a different ethic. And hear how they were treated. So when you hear people today bragging about our Industrial Revolution and how we became the dominant economic and manufacturing power in the world, especially after World War II when Britain was no longer that power, and the Ottoman Empire had been crushed, we were supreme. How did that happen? Who was behind that? That's the story you're going to hear. And then you're going to understand that those people were so betrayed and used and brutalized that they finally fought back. But they didn't initially fight back. They initially did what they were told to do. There was even a very famous song, Tennessee Ford's, 16 Tons and Deeper in Debt. So we're going to show you that part of American history. And then say, do we have that happening today? And the answer is yes. Now, that part will come later this week when I do a whole discussion, 45 minutes, on the politics of debt in America, from debtors' prisons to debtor nation. How many people who are going to school and cannot pay their bills will be arrested, will end up in debtors' prisons. How our government and the corporations working with them are preying on the poor. How many people is that? We're looking in the neighborhood of 200 million. I'll also explain why we are bankrupt, no matter what the talking heads tell you. I'll define the difference between assets and liabilities and debt saturation. And we're way past debt saturation. And we've tried to be told now, and have been, that debt is an asset. No, it isn't. You've been lied to. And I'll explain that. And how the world's banks' payday loans are increasing dire water shortages in Latin America and all the other ways they make money and then exploit. So this is one of those weeks where every single day we're going to get into a social issue and take it to a point where we really understand it. Now, today's issue is foreign policy. And you'll see why everything we're doing, I mean everything, is wrong. And yet every single Republican and both Democrats are going to continue that. The only person capable of changing our foreign policy is Jill Stein, yet she will not be the one that will be heard. She'll be excluded from these forums. So that's what we have coming at you. And then our biggest show of the week is Friday, when I have some spectacular people going to break some original material on the show. Well, I want to thank the people who tuned in on Friday. I got the numbers this morning, just astronomical numbers, somewhere over 63,000 minutes listened, plus all those other people. Thank you. Now let's begin. I'm a vegan. I promote veganism and vegetarianism. I do not believe it's possible for all people to make a radical shift immediately. I believe that we must be both understanding and compassionate, and help people if they make a transition, go from maybe eating meat 3 days, three times a day, to twice a day, to once a day, then to once every other day, once a week, and then no longer meat. And it may take a year to help a person make the transition. But if you do it based upon what that person is capable of doing, at the end of a year, you may have a person who's then contributing less in the way of global warming because they're not requiring the meat. And that meat came from an animal, more often than not, a pig or a cow, that caused methane gas, which is up to minimum of 22 times, but higher in its heat effect than carbon dioxide. But also they get healthier. But there's a lot of reasons to support a plant-based diet. This is the latest. This is from BBC News. Quote, vegetarians are generally less likely than meat eaters to develop cancer, but this does not apply to all forms of the disease. The study involved 60,000 people found those who followed a vegetarian diet developed notably fewer cancers of the blood, bladder, and stomach. This was published in the British Medical Journal. So, if you want to have less multiple myeloma, less non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, less bladder cancer, and stomach cancer, a vegetarian diet. The question is why? Well, because you're getting all those good probiotics, you're getting all that good fiber, and you're getting a lot of antioxidants, and antioxidants trap free radicals. So the more antioxidants you take, the more free radicals you trap, the less inflammation you have. The less inflammation, the less defect to the DNA. The less defect to the DNA, the healthier and longer the life of the cell. So that's big. Now, here's what's interesting. The people who were vegetarians but ate fish, they had, they also had notably less cancer than those that ate meat. So again, we're interested in people making transitions to the ideal would be one day they could have no animal base in their diet. And in an upcoming program, I'll tell you how to be a healthy vegan where you're getting your folate and B12 and plenty of amino acids. One way we can slow the aging process is by consuming more fruits. And berries are at the top of the list of things that you want to include because they have so much antioxidants and phytonutrients. In fact, the more vivid the color of a fruit or vegetable, the more antioxidants it's going to have. And oxidative stress, which I discussed on my last program, damages the cell membranes and the DNA from free radicals. So once you have those fruits, which release their antioxidants, which then trapped and neutralized the free radicals, then the slower the aging process. In this particular study, they looked at specifically blueberries. And what they found was that it's protective for our neurological motor function link, and blueberries reduce, quote, the severity of neurological disease such as Alzheimer's and other dementias. Now, apart from anti-aging properties, blueberries and their antioxidants can help overall. They're great for your urinary tract. They're great because they reduce the adhesion of bacteria on urethra, so they lessen the type of bladder infections people get, urinary tract infections. Now, we know that cranberries did this, but we didn't know blueberries. Now we know. So if you want to have a healthier urethra and bladder, have blueberries and cranberries. So that's good. And for those of you who are depressed, before you reach for the antidepressant drugs, a very popular herbal extract called St. John's wort is the most effective natural herb for helping with the symptoms of depression, more so than antidepressant drugs, and it doesn't have the serious side effects. That's from the Center for Complementary Medicine in Munich. Quote, overall, St. John's wort extract tested in the trials were superior to placebo, similar effective as standard antidepressants, and had fewer side effects than standard antidepressants. And this was published by the Cochrane Library Group. And they looked at 29 separate studies involving thousands of people who either received St. John's wort or placebo. So this was good. All the studies were double-blind. So if someone says, well, where's the good science? Well, here's good science. Double-blind, placebo-controlled study done by a highly respected group, published in a peer-reviewed journal. Will it be taken? No, it won't. It generally takes about 33 years from the time an old way of looking at life in medicine is completely rejected before it changes. But for those listening, it's important you know this. And another recent study done at St. James University Hospital in Leeds, England, found that St. John's wort was the only herbal supplement effective at treating depression. Now, cat's claw, ginseng, ginkgo biloba, royal jelly have all been used, but there's been no clinical evidence that it has made the difference. So that's important. Simple things, inexpensive things, things we can do every day. Now, all of us enjoy a walk in the park or in nature. We just feel more revitalized. We feel better. This is from Shiba University in Japan. Quote, have you ever wondered why you will feel healthier and happier when you stroll through the trees or frolic by the sea? Is it just you're spending time away from work, distressing, taking in the view? Or is it there's more to it? For more than 20 years, scientists have been trying to determine the mechanisms by which exposure to biodiversity improves health. Japanese scientists pioneered the search when they traveled to an island, Yakushima, famous for its biodiversity. The Japanese already had a name for the experience of well-being in nature called Shinrin Yoku, or forest bathing. We do know that a diverse ecosystem supports a varied and beneficial microbiological community living around and inside of us. What we also know is that exposure to green space, even within urban environments, increases our physical and mental well-being. But what are the mechanisms? They found it. It's at least one part of it, the forest air. Japanese researchers suggested that we're taking in beneficial substances when we breathe forest air. Researchers identified three major inhaled factors that can make us feel healthier. These factors are beneficial bacteria, plant-derived essential oils, and negatively charged ions. From birth to grave, beneficial bacteria surround us. They live in the environment and, importantly, in the air we breathe. We also share almost all of our entire body with bacteria. In fact, there's 100 times more bacteria than cells in the body. And the more interactive we have with them, the happier and healthier we are. So this is in part due to our gut-dwelling bacteria, which break down the foods we cannot digest and produce substances of benefit both physically and mentally. Plants and bacteria living on them can produce essential oils to fight off harmful microorganisms, and these are referred to collectively as phytoncides, literally plant-derived exterminators. And research on the health benefits of the plant essential oils has shown so many of these oils to be important. So, one of the things we can do, and even think about doing that within the city, having a space where people could go to, I could just imagine a block that would not be used for anything, get it back from the city, have it bulldozed down, and then, much like the botanical garden, very nice one that's in Central Park at the Children's Zoo, it's small. I'm guessing that it's maybe 6,000 square feet. It's two levels, and they did a really wonderful job in there. You go in, it's very steamy, and they have a pond running around, so you see different types of fish, and you see birds of all types, and forest-dwelling creatures, but you're right in front of them. You're just feet away, and you feel great when you come out of it. Now imagine taking a city block where on the top you have a community garden that's done hydroponically, so it's 12 months a year, supplying food for the communities. And start with the community churches and food banks and shelters where they're desperate for food and they're not getting fresh organic food. Then downstairs, imagine a complete biodiverse tropical rainforest inside where kids could go with teachers and learn about nature, biodiversity, where they could take classes. That's doable, and I'd be willing to support that project. If people in this audience can get a block that could be turned into a living environment, a biodiverse environment, where even having part of it be aromatic, where at my home, at my ranch where I live, I have 14 aromatic plants growing constantly. These are all night bloomers. So at nighttime, when you walk around, you'll smell jasmine and lilac and lavender, honeysuckle. All these wonderful aromas come in. And chrysanthemums. Now imagine having that where people could go in and just sit. You could have 100 chairs. Lounge chairs. People just sit on a lounge chair and just do inhalation therapy, where you have tropical birds and you have water walls and you have a bubbling stream. That's doable. It's absolutely doable. And I think it'd be great for people's health who cannot get to the country, who cannot go by, you know, for a walk in nature, for whatever reason, to have an environment like that, right? And I believe if that worked, and it would, you could implement that as part of a public community, city or state or federal government project in every city in America. Think of all the senior citizens that are stuck in their houses, breathing in unhealthy air, mold, mildews, can't get out. Now imagine that they had a place to go. It's an idea. And remember, everything starts with an idea. University of St. Andrews in Scotland. New research from the university has discovered the psychological links between poverty, inequality, and food consumption. And the research published in the journal Appetite provides the first evidence that people who perceive themselves as poor are more likely to eat more. And the research provides that the first experimental evidence that poverty and inequality can cause obesity through increased consumption of just junk food, high-calorie food, or persons gaining some emotional gratification from eating some comfort food, but they're far more likely to eat that comfort food if they're poor. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come back. A lot to share. Please stay with us.
One ticket, please. Long almost everybody's here. Hey, what's going on, man?
Yeah.
She's at home.
Yeah, she's at home. Yeah, she's at home.
Let the music play. I just wanna dance the night away. Yeah, right here, right here, where I'm gonna stay.
I'd like to welcome you. I'm Gary Nall. This is from Martha Rosenberg from The Influence. She says that we're all aware of these obscene prices the pharmaceutical industry is charging for drugs. And it's just not that this one drug company taking a drug that costs $13.50 retail per pill and then making it go for $750. It's beyond that. Or even this hepatitis C drug, Sovaldi, which was $84,000 for just 12-week course of treatment. She also shows all these other drugs that are coming out at astronomical prices. And why? And it's all based upon increasing the profit of the pharmaceutical company. It has nothing to do with research and development. And they can do this because they virtually have captured the regulatory agencies, the FDA, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, members of the House and Senate, the White House. And they can charge whatever they want. And then they get away with having insurance cover it by traipsing into Capitol Hill for hearings where they control the hearings. They control who's going to appear, and always these doctors or scientists that are there to talk about a hepatitis or an Alzheimer's drug and why it should be covered even though it's expensive. These are all people on their payroll. And then the patients they bring in, you know, cause the legislators to feel, you know, some compassion, and therefore they say, okay, we'll go ahead and cover it. But do these actually work? The answer is no. Do they actually reverse or cure any of these diseases? The answer is no. It's just making tens of billions of dollars a year. But what they found, that they brought out 12 cancer drugs that cost $100,000 each per year. And if a person's on these for 2 years, it's $200,000. That does not include the hospital costs, the oncology costs. Easily can go above $300,000, and then you die, because most people die. And no one talks about that. But look how much they spent in lobbying. And then they show the amount of money they spend in lobbying, and they generally get 100 times back in boosted profit because they get deregulation or they get what they want. Last year, for example, they spent $18.4 million lobbying lawmakers, and it's profitable, comes back as billions of dollars. In fact, the chief lobbyist was pro-Big Pharma from Louisiana, former Representative Billy Tuzin. He resigned from Congress after the Medicare bill was passed, where he made sure that the government had to pay the highest prices for Medicaid and Medicare drugs, and couldn't go out and compete in the marketplace for a lower price generic drug. And he immediately started as the head of the pharmaceuticals, a lobbying arm, at $2 million a year salary. He took 12 people with him from Congress. So this is what we have happening. And the new FDA commissioner, Robert Califf, was confirmed despite 23 financial links to drug makers. He is 100% in the pocket of Big Pharma. And the former chair and CEO of Genentech, Art Levinson, is now CEO of a new Google Life Science venture with Big Pharma. And he brought in Thomas Insel, director of the National Institutes of Mental Health last year, and who's also chairman of Apple Inc., has served as a member of Roche and Genentech. So what you have is you have people from Big Pharma going into government, controlling regulatory processes, then going back into Big Pharma. it should be stopped. There should be a law that you're not allowed to go to work in the industries that you had any oversight in. Now let's listen to a part of a documentary called Plutocracy, Political Repression in the United States. This, I've selected this clip because this represents what it would have been like if you were a blue-collar worker back in the 1800s to the 1930s. And here's what they went through. Now, there'll be periods of time where it's a little slow. That's because in the film you're seeing visuals. But listen, please listen to the narrative because it's extremely accurate. And then I'm going to do a follow-up commentary of how applicable that is to many people today that we don't see. We don't see their suffering. We don't see people living on $2 or less a day today in the United States. We don't see 1.6 million children going out of school and not having a home to go to. We don't see 18 million children who are hungry each day. We don't see 100 million Americans at or below the poverty line. We don't see any of this. They're invisible. I believe that as a nation filled with compassionate people, which we have, that we should understand that where we made great strides against all opposition, we are losing and becoming futile again. We have these oligarchs. We have people like the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Goulds, the Swearingers, the Hills, the Rockefellers, the Fricks. We have them all over again, except these people are even more ruthless and have a greater capacity to have a negative influence on people's lives. Listen in, please.
There was a town marshal, a law enforcement officer paid by the company. The company store held a monopoly on goods sold to workers and their families. Company officials were appointed as election judges. Company teachers, using company-approved textbooks, taught the next generation of children. Company-appointed doctors and lawyers prevented injured employees from collecting damages. The laws were the company's rules. Author Denise Giardini describes typical working conditions. They broke their backs and died of roof falls and rib rolls and gas. Their children went to bed hungry and died of the typhoid. Their wives took the consumption. They themselves coughed and spit up. They stayed in debt to the company store. They had no say at the mine or freedom of any kind. They could be let go at a moment's notice and put out in the road or beaten or shot. Black lung disease and other work-related ailments took thousands of lives, while catastrophic accidents were a daily concern. On December 6, 1907, the most deadly mine disaster in U.S. history occurred when an explosion killed 361 men and boys in a West Virginian coal mine owned by the Fairmont Corporation. The earth shook as far as 8 miles away, knocking people and horses off their feet. Frantic women spent days searching through the wreckage for their loved ones. In the words of one witness, their shrieks of agony were not to move the hardest heart to sorrow. At the time of the disaster, the American coal industry was only half a century old, yet had already killed and crippled more men than during any battle of the Civil War. Accident rates in American mines were double that of Germany, three times that of England, and four times that of France. Workers were fighting back, and gains were being made. In its 2003 American Labor History themed study, the U.S. National Park Service recognized that strike activity from the time period was not just motivated by economic concerns. It also involved freedom from industrial feudalism, freedom from the terrorism inflicted by hired gunmen, and the struggle for liberties promised in the Bill of Rights. In 1912, coal miners in Kanawha County, West Virginia, issued a list of demands, including a shorter workday, the right to organize, recognition of a worker's constitutional rights to free speech and assembly, an end to the blacklisting of union organizers, and alternatives to company stores. The requested pay raise would have cost the company 15 cents per miner per day. Instead of negotiating, the company hired a private militia to break the strike. The Baldwin Felts Detective Agency had become notorious throughout the region for using violence to prevent union organizing. 300 private detectives arrived and began evicting families from their homes, forcing the miners to set up a tent colony at Holly Grove. In July, the Irish immigrant and labor activist Mother Jones arrived to show her support. Jones had been declared the most dangerous woman in America due to her success in organizing workers. A decade earlier, she led a children's march from Philadelphia to the hometown of President Theodore Roosevelt, demanding an end to child labor. In Kanawha County, Jones persuaded more workers to join the strike. Along with Frank Keeney of the United Mine Workers, she then arranged a march of 3,000 miners to the state capitol in Charleston, where she read the Declaration of Independence. The miners saw themselves as industrial slaves, and they were ready to rebel against their masters. On July 26th, strikers attacked Baldwin Felt's agents in the town of Mucklow. 4 guards and 12 strikers were killed. The state government declared martial law. Attacks against miners in Kanawha by both police and private security forces were routine and often deadly. In February, a posse led by the local sheriff, Bonner Hill, drove a heavily armored train nicknamed the Bull Moose Special toward the tent colony at Holly Grove, then opened fire with a machine gun. One man was killed and over a dozen wounded. A few days later, another police raid killed several men. Mother Jones was arrested on February 13th and charged in military court. Refusing to recognize the court's jurisdiction, she was convicted of incitement to riot and conspiracy to commit murder. Her sentence, 20 years in the state penitentiary. As winter set in, conditions in the tent colony grew increasingly dire. At least a dozen men died from starvation. In March, West Virginians elected a new governor. He took a more conciliatory approach, freeing 30 miners held under martial law statutes and transferring Mother Jones to Charleston for medical treatment. She was released after 85 days. The strikers were forced to accept a settlement under threat of deportation from the state. Some workers continued to fight for another 6 months. According to a later study by the Senate's Committee on Education and Labor, about 50 violent deaths had occurred during the Paint Cabin Creek strike, mostly workers. Yet no reforms resulted. Even as the mining of coal drove the American economy to new heights, the men and boys who removed it from the ground were considered expendable. Similar events would take place 8 years later when striking miners in Matewan, West Virginia, were subjected to a series of assaults by Baldwin Felt detectives employed by the Stone Mountain Coal Company. Workers and their families were evicted from their homes, while union organizers were blacklisted and beaten. Events came to a head when Matewan's police chief, Sid Hatfield, made the rare move of siding with the workers against the company. A gunfight broke out, killing 7 detectives and 3 townsmen. In 1921, Hatfield was charged with dynamiting a coal tipple, an allegation most miners considered fraudulent. As he ascended the courthouse steps with his deputy, Ed Chambers, both men were gunned down in cold blood. At the time, the United Mine Workers were facing setbacks. Though they had successfully organized much of West Virginia, the southern coal fields remained entirely in the control of corporations. 80% of mines in the area had reopened due to the importing of replacement workers, commonly called scabs, while returning strikers were required to sign so-called yellow dog contracts, agreements in which workers pledged not to join a union. A coal company lawyer, S.B. Avis, explained the concerns of management. It is like a servant lives at your house. If the servant leaves your employment, if you discharge him, you ask him to get out of the servant's quarters. It is a question of master and servant. Evicted from their homes, miners set up tent colonies and began a campaign of guerrilla warfare, engaging in skirmishes up and down the Tug Fork River. Casualties resulted on both sides. In May, the government declared martial law, but the legislation was unequally enforced. Workers were the primary target, with hundreds arrested and denied habeas corpus rights. When Sid Hatfield was shot, the miners decided that they had had enough. Men along the Little Coal River were the first to militarize, setting up guard posts and patrols. Meanwhile, word of the unlawful executions was spreading. In a matter of days, some 12,000 coal miners took up arms and began planning a march on Logan and Mingo counties. The goal was to free imprisoned workers, end martial law, and organize the entire region. Standing in the way was Blair Mountain, a 2,000-foot natural impediment occupied by the National Guard. The war was defined by class. Most lower-class workers supported the insurrection. In contrast, Logan County Sheriff Don Chaffin made an appeal to business owners. Americans should do their patriotic duty, he claimed, by opposing the workers and preventing mob rule. Chaffin's salary was partly subsidized by the coal companies. The miners wore red bandanas, earning them the nickname Rednecks. It was the largest armed uprising in the United States since the Civil War. Coal Coal Company forces were heavily armed with cutting-edge munitions, including machine guns and even planes, which were used to drop homemade chemical weapons and shrapnel bombs on the Redneck Army. At one point, bombers from Maryland were flown in to perform aerial surveillance.
It continues. It goes on. Well, I'm going to play this segment. Keep in mind what we're doing here. We're hearing what happened, the government's response, and how similar that is today around the world.
Weaponry, and despite their superior tactical position, the National Guard was outnumbered 3-1. Equally important, the rebels had extensive knowledge of the terrain. While the guardsmen felled trees and dug trenches, the miners made use of natural pathways, rapidly ascending the mountain. According to archaeologist Harvard Ayers, who made an extensive study of Blair Mountain artifacts, the Redneck Army would almost certainly have won the battle, but the coal companies had a trump card. On September 1, 1921, President Warren G. Harding sent in federal troops from Fort Thomas, Kentucky. The miners, many of whom had fought in World War I, refused to engage American soldiers. Many even celebrated their arrival, regarding them as comrades in arms. But their trust was misplaced. After surrendering, 1,217 indictments were laid down, including 325 for murder and 24 for treason. It is likely that many of the miners would have been executed, but the public was sympathetic to their plight. Of the men convicted, most only served a few years in prison. Bill Blizzard, who was regarded by authorities as the general of the miners' army, was first tried at the Jefferson County Courthouse in Charlestown, the same building in which John Brown had been tried for treason in 1859. Brown had led a failed revolt against the institution of slavery in the United States and was subsequently hanged. Blizzard, though tried several times in several different locations, was eventually acquitted. The West Virginian Mine Wars were part of a broader conflict between the forces of labor and the forces of capital, a struggle that claimed the lives of thousands of American workers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Thousands more were beaten, maimed, imprisoned, tortured, and sent to early graves due to poor working conditions and dismal safety standards.
According to historians. Now, you can continue listening to the entire segment on my website. I'm going to offer two different understandings based upon what is happening today. And it's all based upon context. If, for example, you were with me while I was filming my documentary Poverty, Inc., or Americans, Veterans, Forgotten and Betrayed, where I found 16,000 living in the woods of Florida with no money, no electricity, no health care, nothing. They were absolutely destitute. Some would pass around a loaf of bread. I watched this. And I said, I will make a documentary, which I have done, and hopefully inspire the public to realize your suffering. But unfortunately, nothing has changed for them because so many Americans, because they're not suffering to that degree and do not understand their connection at a spiritual level to others who are, simply go on with their day distracted by their own issues. If you're an affluent person, you rarely have an opportunity to meet and to understand what it is to be one who is struggling. And so it's all on context. Then beyond context is conditioning. Here is Chris Hedges' response on voting with your feet. I will not read all of it. I'll read part of it. Bernie Sanders' political corpse in the presidential race is still warm, but some of his prominent liberal supporters already are urging us to flee to Hillary Clinton. Sanders, who knows the game is up, will soon become the Democrats' Pied Piper. He will seek to entice his supporters into the Democratic rat trap. He has decried the disruption of the Trump rallies, denigrating the only power we have left, saying people should not disrupt anybody's meetings. His political revolution, like his promise of a movement, is a cynical form of advertising. Sanders will, like the Barack Obama 2008, end up as an impediment to the mass movements he claims to represent, and mass movements in our system of inverted totalitarianism are our final and only hope. I understand the fear over Donald Trump. I too want to crush the growing fascist sentiments rising up from the rotten decay of American society. But voting for Clinton and supporting the Democratic Party will not halt our descent into despotism. It will only accelerate it. Trump is not creating a phenomenon. He's responding to them. It is up to us to halt the array of forces that are preparing a species of American fascism and orchestrating a global ecocide. The only way we have left to vote is with our feet. When fundamental rights are abolished by the state, and it is not as if we have much time left. James Josh Fox, in his brutally honest film about the looming effects of economic change, how climate change, how to let go of the world and love all the things climate can change, notes that we have cut 80% of all carbon emissions by 2012. If we have not, then there's just no hope of saving Greenland's ice sheet. The Paris climate talks were a step backwards. The loss of the polar ice will flood coastal cities around the globe. It will trigger a global ecological catastrophe. It will displace hundreds of millions of people. It will bring, if not revolution, violence, anarchy, chaos, suffering, and death that will rival the Black Plague. And our elites intend to do nothing to stop it. The fact alone should send us into the streets. The Democrats, and particularly Hillary and Bill Clinton, are responsible as much as anyone on the right for our being sacrificed on the altar of corporate profit. They told the same lies as the right-wingers. They fed the same hate. They, too, orchestrated the corporate coup. The Clintons removed from the Democratic Party platform the progressive stances championed by Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition. They spoke early in their careers in the coded racism of law and order. They transformed the Democratic Party into the old Republican Party. They unleashed the predators of Wall Street and the fossil fuel industry. They stripped us of our civil liberties, championed endless war, and empowered the arms industry and agencies such as Homeland Security to suck the marrow out of the federal budget. The Clintons and Democratic Party filled the prisons and destroyed welfare. And under Barack Obama, it has gotten worse. Obama authorized the assassination of U.S. citizens. He signed into law legislation that permits the military to act as a domestic police force and detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without due process. He and the Democratic Party establishment are attempting to ram new trade agreements down our throats. It pays to betray the citizenry. The Clintons have made over $153 million for paid speeches alone since 2001. The Democratic Party is awash in corporate cash, and the Obamas will soon, like the Clintons, be multimillionaires. The two parties colluded to turn American politics into anti-politics. The culture wars replaced political debate. The Democrats co-opted the liberal elites and unions. The Republican Party embraced the lunatics of the Christian right and opponents of abortion rights. The Republicans and Democrats looked at their supporters as useful idiots. It worked for a while. Then the manipulated and the abandoned sent the elites back to their gated estates. Voters flocked to Trump haters' rallies and fueled Sanders' political insurgency. It was a bankrupt liberal establishment that made possible the rise of totalitarianism in Germany and Russia in the 20th century. The great intellectuals, writers, philosophers, and artists from Dostoevsky to Hannah Arendt, who fought against emergent fascism and communism, warned about a failed liberalism. They understood that stories of rage were, first of all, stories of despair. Liberalism, by constantly betraying its stated values, neutered and discredited itself as a political force. Its self-destruction left the working poor bereft of their only means of halting their abject exploitation and abuse. Incremental and piecemeal reform became impossible. When the underclasses turned against the liberal establishment, they rejected not only their representatives, but also the values liberals claimed to represent, and they searched for a leader who promised a new glory, moral renewal, and vengeance. there are mechanisms to wrest back our democracy. Voting in presidential elections is not one of them. We must, in large or small ways, disrupt the system. Street demonstrations to denounce the party, conventions in Cleveland and Philadelphia would expose the political theater. Unfortunately, the state, whose fear of protests is pathological, will impose de facto martial law in the host cities during the conventions as it has in the past. It will flood the streets with militarized police, set up mazes of barricades, and deploy the usual array of militarized hardware, including drones and helicopters, and crowd control technology. The state has, I suspect, already infiltrated and is monitoring any group it believes might attempt to protest. Authorities will work to make it impossible for any demonstrator to get within blocks of the convention halls. Sustained mass civil disobedience, if not in Cleveland and Philadelphia, then in other parts of the country that can impede the machinery of corporate power, is our only hope. That's one point of view. There is another, one that never gets attention, and I will quote it verbatim from Ian Welsh, and it says, "Why poor white males are the core of Trump's support." This is not hard to understand. Quote from Ian, "Wages for working-class white males peaked in 1968, 48 years ago. Coincidentally, I was born in 1968. For their entire working lives, conditions for working-class males have been getting worse. Free trade has not worked for them. China joined the World Trade Organization in 2000. So for nearly 48 years, poor whites have done terribly. For 48 years, ordinary politicians have promised to do something about it, and nothing has improved. Do not tell me or them that they are privileged. Yes, it is better to be poor and white than poor and black, better to be poor white than poor a white woman. But people who are in pain do not react well to some smug upper-class jerk telling them that they are privileged when their lives are clearly terrible. It is a fact that working-class whites will not see any improvements worth mentioning under any normal politician, including Clinton. They may see an improvement under Trump. They certainly would under Sanders. They are voting for what they see as their interest, and they are not necessarily wrong. Certainly Trump is more likely to help than Clinton, as the chance of Clinton helping them is zero, zip, nada. It is insanity to expect poor white males to accept 48 years of decline and not get angry. It is perfectly reasonable for them to respond to a man who offers them a better life in a way that is different from all the politicians who have failed them in the past. Trump does not feel or campaign like an ordinary politician. Poor whites read this as he might not betray us, like all the normal politicians do. They think at least it's worth a try. Now, when I say poor whites, smart people should hear people who are willing to be violent. Who mans America's actual fighting regiments? That's right, poor whites. Who are the police? Who are your prison guards? Right, even if they make decent money as a cop or a guard, they're poor whites by culture, Scots-Irish core. These are bad people to alienate to the point where they are willing to turn en masse to a demagogue. You may not just like this, but the cold reality is that you need to keep the people who enjoy violence under control and ideally happy, wanting other things more than they want to crack skulls. At the least, you make sure that they do not do it. You have to be really stupid to lose control of your society's fighting class. You have to be real stupid to degrade them over a period of decades, to employ them en masse in jobs where they beat up other people. Demonizing poor white men as trailer trash has simply alienated them. Telling them that they are sexist, racist scum has not raised their consciousness. Strangely, they don't think that all the people who tell them they're bad are right. Instead, they think those are people who are really stupid. So that's another perspective from a person giving you what it's like in that environment. So think about that. Two different approaches. One's very scholarly, one of the smartest men, one of the most learned minds in the world, Chris Hedges. Another's just a person who is speaking on behalf of what you constantly hear. Is anyone not voting for their party must be a redneck, must be stupid, must be a racist, must be all these things. And then you turn out a couple hundred people to stop a rally or block it? Think for a moment. Are we a nation that supports freedom of speech and freedom of choice? If we are, then let those people have their rallies, let them have their speeches, and we who could oppose them will oppose them through the legitimate constitutional means we have. But to say that they're worth nothing, they're lower than nothing, and to denigrate them, to exclude them from any semblance of being a human being and their children, as if they're just the white trash. Now go back to the 1800s, go back to the 1900s, go back to what the average working or upper middle class person or rich person thought of the people in those minds. They were thought of as the same way. They were given no thought that they were human beings, and hence children were worked 12 hours a day until they died, with no consequences. People spent everything they had at a company store but could never get out of debt. And we had debt peonage, and it was all legal. And when they did strike finally, and when they returned to show that they would not tolerate this, the federal government stepped in and conquered all. And what are we doing today but replaying this scenario? Different time, very similar mindset. Do not denigrate someone because they're poor. Do not libel someone because they are not of your education, your class. Because the day that you think you're right and you represent the only voice that should be heard and the only demonstration that should exist and the only rally that should be attended, remember there's 200 million of them waiting out there and they're pissed. Remember that. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right. Have a good time, 'cause it's all right. Whoa, it's all right. We're gonna move it slow. When lights are low, when you move it slow, it sounds like a moan, and it's all right. Whoa, it's all right. Now listen to the beat, kind of pat your feet.